So tomorrow, America turns 250.
Yep, big one.
Yeah, the big one. But depending on, which political party planner you actually ask, you are either going to a neighborhood block party celebrating civic unity, or you're attending a highly partisan rally funded by a shadow LLC.
Complete with an AI-generated George Washington
All
button.
right, exactly. So today is Friday, July 3, 2026. The U.S. semiquincentennial is literally hours away.
It's wild that it's finally here.
I know, right? And we have an absolutely massive stack of sources to go through for this deep dive today. We're pulling from congressional oversight reports, cultural essays, demographic studies, and some really fresh polling data.
There's a lot of ground to cover.
There really is. So our mission today is to basically give you a shortcut. We want you to understand not just how the country is throwing this party tomorrow, but the really intense ideological battles happening backstage, plus how everyday Americans actually feel walking into this weekend and, well, what all of this signals for the next 250 years.
Right.
So, okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, to really understand the tension right now, you have to look at the two radically different models of celebration happening simultaneously across the country.
Two completely different vibes.
Completely different. These aren't just different event schedules. They represent two entirely different ways of curating American reality.
Yeah.
On one hand, you have cities taking this highly decentralized, community-focused approach. Philadelphia is actually the perfect case study here.
Oh, Philadelphia's itinerary is fascinating because they have 67 National Historic Landmarks, right? So they are leaning heavily into that physical heritage.
Exactly.
But their approach to tomorrow is almost entirely rooted in grassroots community and sports. I mean, they are hosting the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, the FIFA World Cup 26 Fan Fest, Wawa Welcome America, and the Homecoming 250 celebrating the Navy and Marine Corps.
Right.
It feels very, I don't know, very civic. But why build a 250th anniversary around baseball and soccer?
Well, because a sports civic framing creates a shared physical reality. When you gather people for a World Cup fan fest or a baseball game, the barrier to entry isn't ideological.
Oh, interesting.
Right. It's geographic. You are there because you belong to that city. It treats the anniversary as a communal festival, focusing on shared space rather than, shared politics.
Right, you're just a Philly fan or just an American soccer fan.
Exactly. But the moment we shift our focus to Washington, D.C., that communal festival model just vanishes. The White House has centralized its national events under this initiative called Freedom 250.
Okay.
And the events on the National Mall are taking on a highly ideological flavor. I mean, they're hosting a rededicate 250 prayer rally.
And that features some pretty prominent conservative religious figures, right? Like Franklin Graham and Paula White
Yeah,
King.
exactly.
Which brings us to this explosive backroom battle over who is actually running the Washington operation, because we have this highly detailed interim Democratic staff report from the House Committee on Natural Resources.
Titled From Vanity to Insanity, which is quite the name.
Yeah, very subtle. So we're going to unpack what the Democratic authors are alleging here, because the mechanics they describe are just stunning. They claim the White House effectively hijacked the celebration from a bipartisan commission established back in 2016
Right.
and replaced it with a shadow LLC lodged inside the National Park Foundation. For those of us who don't, spend our days reading tax law, how does a shadow LLC actually function in this context?
So a shadow LLC essentially acts as a financial black box.
Okay.
When you nest a private limited liability company inside a nonprofit foundation, so in this case, the National Park Foundation, you create a loophole.
A loophole for money.
Right. Federal money and private donations can go into that foundation, but the standard public transparency rules and congressional oversight that normally apply to federal projects, they just don't apply to the LLC's expenditures on the way out.
Wow. And the Democratic report claims that this specific black box, Freedom 250, siphoned $50 million in congressional appropriations away from that original bipartisan group.
Yep, that's the allegation.
They also allege the LLC used deceptive wire transfers to basically trick donors who thought they were giving to the nonpartisan commission. So, where did the Democratic authors say this money is actually going?
Well, according to the committee report, massive federal contracts are being steered directly to political allies. The authors specifically point to an event management firm called Event Strategies, Inc., or ESI.
ESI, right.
And the report details that ESI is the exact same firm that organized the January 6 rallies back in 2021.
Oh, wow.
And now they hold the contracts to plan the nation's 250th celebrations on the National Mall.
That is wow. But the conflict outlined in these sources goes way beyond just event management contracts. It's a battle over the official historical record itself.
Yes.
The Democratic Oversight Report points to a White House executive order, EWO 14253, and the authors allege this order is currently being used to aggressively scrub information regarding LGBTQ rights, climate change, and the history of slavery from national parks across the country.
Right, they're changing what's actually on display.
Exactly. And you have to contrast those removals with what Freedom 250 is physically pushing out into the country, which is a fleet of federally funded freedom trucks.
Yeah, the Freedom Trucks, they're basically mobile museums. And their content was developed by conservative organizations like PragerU and Hillsdale College. The Democratic report argues these trucks are disseminating a highly revised, kind of Christian nationalist version of history. And they highlight several glaring historical controversies within the exhibits.
Like what?
Well, for example, the trucks claim that Muhammad Ali eventually abandoned Islam.
Which is not true.
Right, a claim the Council on American Islamic Relations has strongly debunked.
Yeah, the report also flags that these trucks make debunked claims about Congress authorizing the Aitken Bible as the official Bible of the United States. And maybe most wildly, and you mentioned this earlier, they feature an AI-generated George Washington reciting fabricated quotes about rights being a gift from God. Like, historians have no record of him ever saying these words. It's like two rival party planners fighting over the playlist, but the playlist is American history itself.
That's a great way to put it.
But I have to ask, is this just standard Washington political theater? Or does manufacturing quotes from founding fathers represent a structural shift in how our history is officially recorded?
It goes far beyond standard political theater. I mean, the core strategy here is that whoever controls the narrative of the past ultimately controls the political vision for the future. If an administration can firmly establish, even through, AI-generated quotes, that the founding of the country was fundamentally based on a specific exclusionary religious framework, they can use that revised precedent to justify modern exclusionary policy decisions.
So the fight over 1776 is simply the battlefield being used to determine the laws of 2026.
Exactly.
Okay, let's transition away from the politicians fighting over the guest list and let's look at the actual guests, the American people.
Yeah, the actual citizens.
How did they feel walking into this weekend? I know we have fresh polling data from Heartland Forward. Does it reflect the same bitter divide we are seeing in Washington?
It does, but in a deeply paradoxical way. So the Heartland Forward polling shows a population deeply in love with the concept of their country, but terrified of its reality.
What do the numbers look like?
Look at the foundational numbers. 84% of Americans in the Heartland say there's no limit to what we can achieve when we are united.
That's huge.
It is. 77% say they are proud to be American. 86% say the founding documents still feel profoundly relevant to their daily lives.
Okay, but.
But flip to the other side of that exact same poll. Despite all of that foundational pride, 53% of those same respondents believe that America's best days are definitively behind us.
See, here's where it gets really interesting. How do you reconcile that? Like, how can someone be so deeply proud of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, but simultaneously believe the country is in an irreversible decline?
It really comes down to a collision between economic anxiety and how patriotism has been weaponized. A recent Wall Street Journal opinion panel discussion broke this down brilliantly. They noted that patriotism itself has become heavily coded by partisanship. Right now, Democrats are expressing significantly lower levels of national pride, largely as a direct reaction to the current Republican administration holding the White House.
Right, it's situational.
Exactly. Meanwhile, conservatives show much more consistent vocal expressions of patriotism. The panel framed it as a cultural clash between two distinct views of the nation's founding, the 1776 view versus the 1619 Project view.
Let's define those for the listener real quick. So the 1776 view sees the founding as an imperfect but noble birth based on ideals of liberty.
Right.
The 1619 Project view, which was introduced by the New York Times, centers the nation's true origin around the arrival of the first enslaved people in Virginia. So it argues that the country's core institutions were built on a foundation of systemic racism.
Exactly. And when you view the country through those fundamentally different historical lenses, every modern issue looks completely different.
And when patriotism is tied to which political party happens to be occupying the White House or which historical lens you use, it ceases to be a unifying national force. It becomes just another partisan weapon.
Yes, exactly. But within our sources, there is a really interesting proposal for how to bypass this gridlock. Chris Romer, the president of the Vail Valley Partnership, introduces a concept he calls pragmatic patriotism.
He calls it optimism in a cowboy hat, which is just fantastic branding.
It really is.
But Romer's recipe is essentially an amalgamation of the greatest hits of the 20th century. He argues we need a philosophy rooted in results, not ideology.
Right, taking the best parts of what actually worked.
Exactly. So he borrows Ronald Reagan's peace through strength and foreign policy. He mixes in Bill Clinton's economic sensibility regarding free markets.
Mm.
He adds Dwight Eisenhower's belief in massive infrastructure investment as the connective tissue of the economy. Then he folds in Lyndon B. Johnson's push for equal opportunity and civil rights and tops it off with John F. Kennedy's idealism and call to public service.
It's quite the list. And the logic behind Romer's mix is that these elements actually complement each other when applied practically.
How so?
Well, you can't have Eisenhower's booming infrastructure without LBJ's equal opportunity ensuring the whole workforce can participate, right?
Right.
You can't fund Kennedy's public service ideals without Clinton's booming free markets generating the capital. So it is a synthesis of American political success stories designed to offer a practical path forward, one that explicitly ignores the extremes of both the far left and the far right.
Okay, I have to challenge this concept directly, though. Is pragmatic patriotism just a buffet plate of past presidents?
I mean,
like, in a deeply polarized 2026, where we can't even agree on whether George Washington actually said the quotes on the side of a federally funded truck, does a mix and match political nostalgia actually resonate with you, the listener? Or is it just a fantasy for moderates who wish it was 1995 again?
Well, what's fascinating here is that while it absolutely sounds like a nostalgic buffet, the craving for this kind of middle ground reveals a profound exhaustion among the electorate.
People are just tired.
They are so tired. People are drowning in information overload, performative politics, and endless culture wars. Romer's concept resonates not because of the specific presidency names, but because it focuses on the unglamorous mechanics of governing.
Right. Fixing roads.
Fixing roads, balancing budgets, maintaining global alliances. When the ideological battles become too abstract and exhausting, voters just start demanding basic competence. They just want the potholes filled.
But fixing those potholes and maintaining the infrastructure and economy Romer's talking about requires a stable working class foundation, and that requires actual people, which brings us to the Conservative Heritage Foundation report.
Yes.
The authors of this report sound a massive alarm about the physical future of the American population. They argue that we might not actually have the people to build the future we are talking about.
Yeah, the demographic math in the Heritage Report is stark. They draw this really interesting historical contrast. The 54 signers of the Declaration of Independence had an average of 6 children each.
Wow. 6 each?
Yeah, that's 337 children just among the founders. Today, in 2026, the U.S. fertility rate has plummeted to a record low of 1.59 births per woman.
Just to clarify the math for everyone listening, a fertility rate of 2.1 is the replacement rate. That is the exact number of births required just to keep a population stable without relying on immigration. We are far below that.
Very far below.
So how does the Heritage Foundation explain this collapse?
The Heritage authors argue it is a structural mechanism driven by government policy and cultural shifts. They argue that when a government expands its welfare state, the economic necessity of the nuclear family shrinks.
Because you don't need kids to run the farm anymore.
Exactly. Historically, a family needed children to help run a farm or to provide financial support in old age. When the state takes over those safety nets, the cultural imperative shifts away from family formation and toward individual career advancement and personal fulfillment.
Okay, I see.
And they argue this resulting birth dearth threatens the very foundation of our institutions, particularly safety nets like Social Security, which mathematically rely on a growing young workforce to support an aging population.
So you have think tanks in Washington panicking about the birth rate and drafting policies to encourage family formation. But let's look at the reality of the generation they're actually talking about, Gen Z.
Right, the ones actually expected to have these kids.
Exactly. The Americans born between 1996 and 2009. Returning to that Wall Street Journal panel, the insights paint a picture of a generation living with a completely different cultural lens. I mean, just look at their slang.
Yeah, the slang's a great indicator.
The panel noted how Gen Z might complement a fantastic outfit by saying it's totally eating. It's a completely distinct cultural language.
It is a distinct language, and they're living a distinct paradox right now. Demographically, Gen Z is the most anxious and the least formally religious generation in recorded American history.
Okay.
And yet there is a palpable, almost desperate search for meaning happening right now. The WSJ panel noted a fascinating trend. Traditional Catholic churches in New York are suddenly packed with young people.
Wait, really?
Yeah. They aren't looking for modernized, casual services. They're looking for ancient, tactile, traditional faith experiences to anchor them.
Wow. But when it comes to the country itself, their patriotism is deeply fractured. The polling shows that 65% of Gen Z Republicans say they are proud to be American. But for Gen Z Democrats, it's just 24%.
It's a massive gap.
And even the forms of progressive patriotism that were huge cultural touchstones just a decade ago, like think of the smash hit musical Hamilton, are now viewed incredibly skeptically by younger, left-leaning crowds. The panel noted they see it as cringe or overly romanticized propaganda.
Yeah, this is a generation that grew up with the entirety of the world's problems in their pockets, right? Mm-hmm. Constantly pinging them with notifications of doom.
Right.
But the panel highlighted a really optimistic silver lining. Gen Z is actively seeking to untether from technology.
How so?
They are intentionally seeking out analog experiences. They are returning to in-person movie theaters in record numbers. They are buying physical vinyl records. They are craving offline physical connection away from the algorithm.
So what does this all mean? Consider this. What if Gen Z isn't rejecting patriotism entirely, but just rejecting the digital version of it?
Oh, that's an interesting thought.
Right. The digital version of America right now is a toxic timeline of people screaming at each other over fake quotes and shadow LLCs. If they are untethering and seeking offline connection, like packing those movie theaters or going to a physical church, maybe they believe the future of American unity isn't going to be found under a massive national political banner.
Yeah.
Maybe they believe it has to be hyper-local, built face-to-face in their actual physical community.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, I think you've hit on something vital. Gen Z's search for physical, local community might actually be the modern antidote to the massive demographic and institutional anxieties raised by the Heritage Foundation.
Really? How does that fix the birth rate?
Well, if national politics feels irredeemably broken and alienating, the natural human response is to rebuild at the local level.
Yeah.
You cannot legislate a generation into having families or feeling patriotic.
Sure.
They have to feel a sense of safety and belonging in their immediate physical surroundings first. That grassroots approach we saw in Philadelphia might just be the blueprint for the next century.
Let's take a breath and look at the ground we've covered today. As you head into the July 4th weekend, you are standing at a massive crossroads.
We really are.
We've navigated the huge grassroots civic celebrations kicking off in places like Philadelphia. We've unpacked the fierce partisan backroom battles in Washington, complete with shadow LLCs and revised history over how to even tell America's story.
Yeah.
We've seen the heartland's enduring hope fighting against its own economic anxiety. And we've looked at Gen Z, a generation pulling away from their screens to figure out how to physically inhabit this country for the coming centuries. This matters to you because you aren't just reading history tomorrow. You are living through the exact hinge point of the next American era.
And this raises an important question, something that sits beneath everything we've discussed today. The U.S. semiquincentennial tomorrow is the very first centennial-scale American anniversary taking place in the age of personalized algorithms.
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought about that.
Think about 1976. For the bicentennial, almost everyone in the country watched the exact same fireworks on the exact same three television networks anchored by the exact same broadcasters.
They shared a singular national reality.
Exactly. Tomorrow, millions of Americans will experience a completely different algorithmically customized version of America's birthday, fed directly to their individual screens based on their existing political biases. The reality they experience online will be entirely fractured.
So we are all going to the exact same birthday party, but we are all standing in completely different rooms.
We are. And those rooms are designed to make us suspicious of the people in the other rooms.
So as the fireworks go off tomorrow night, I want to leave you with one lingering question to mull over. As we step into the future, how will we ever write the history of our 300th anniversary if we no longer share the same present?